I'm Dr. Leif Tappanilla from the Idaho Museum of Natural History. I'm here with Peter Pruitt from Zoo Idaho. This is The Nature of Idaho. Coming from the 1B, we're talking all about Idaho, its wild places and wild faces, the natural setting that makes Idaho an incredible place to live and be proud of. Well, today our guest is Dr. Renee Love, instructor of geology at the University of Idaho, and we will be talking about one of the world's greatest deposits of fossil leaves found along the western edge of Idaho.
This is going to be exciting. Totally out of my wheelhouse, Leif. I'm used to working with things that are living.
I love to make you uncomfortable.
Oh, yes, and it's great. I love to be uncomfortable.
Onward we will go. How about you tell us about some nature news.
Perfect.
Okay.
In a new study at the Northwestern University, researchers have induced jet lag in a fruit fly model of Huntington disease and found that the jet lag actually protected the fruit fly's neurons.
Wait. I understand jet lag, right?
Yeah.
You've flown across a bunch of time zones, yep. You land, and now your internal clock is all messed up. I don't know how they do this in a fruit fly, but go on.
Yeah, I'm not sure either, you know, but they did it. And what they found is that this jet lag, you know, they disrupted their circadian clock,
okay.
Actually helped on repairing a lot of the neurodegenerative damage off of Huntington disease. And you know, this is totally opposite of what everyone is thinking. You know, they think that sleep disruption precedes other symptoms of some type of neurological disease or degeneration. And it's totally backwards. And these guys were baffled with this whole thing. So what do scientists do? They figure out a new test.
All right.
So some more research. And so they found this gene that is controlled by the circadian clock that actually folds proteins. And if these proteins in the brain aren't folded correctly, then that's a setting for a neurodegenerative disease. And guess what? Once they mess with their circadian rhythm, there was reduced neuron damage. So again, the disruption or the lack of sleep actually helped this gene in producing correctly folded proteins.
That's bizarre. That's counterintuitive. So a lack of sleep may have helped in this case.
Yeah.
For our poor jet-lagged fruit flies,
right,
to keep them from getting neural disorders.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. So, you know, I suppose with everything, you know, moderation is the key. So just a little bit of jet lag or a little bit of sleep stress actually can be good, not only for fruit flies, but for us.
Well, that's the weirdest nature news I think we've done so far.
I think it was the hardest one to kind of go, really?
Really?
Because it is absolutely goes against the grain of everything that we've heard or even makes sense.
Well, research is a fun thing because you can dig into all sorts of different topics and learn some new information. Today, we've got a really cool topic all about past climate as viewed through the fossil leaves that we get here in Idaho. And like we do in all shows, we like to start our show off with a little bit of trivia. So related to today's theme, we're going to ask the question, what was the average temperature in Idaho 16 million years ago? Now, that seems like a long time ago, and I'm a geologist. I'm usually thinking in the hundreds of millions of years. So 16 million years ago is a long time ago, but, you know, it's not that, you know, that's not that long ago, right?
No, not at all.
Now, so the question is, what was the average temperature in Idaho 16 million years ago? But just for reference, just to help you along, if you looked at Boise today, Boise's average temperature annually is about 52 degrees Fahrenheit. So was it hotter back 16 million years ago, or was it colder? I guess we'll get to that when we talk to our guest today. But first, let's go to a little station break, and we'll come right on back for that interview.
This is KISU-FM Pocatello, Idaho Falls, Rexburg. Also available on your Amazon or Google smart speaker with the command, play KISU.
Hey, we're back here at Nature of Idaho, and we want to welcome our guest today, Dr. Renee Love. She's an instructor of geology at the University of Idaho. So thanks for joining us today on The Nature of Idaho. Welcome, Renee.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, so I'm really looking forward to this topic because I'm a paleontologist and I study fossils. And when I first moved here to Idaho back in 2005, somebody showed me in our museum some specimens of fossil leaves that come from the western part of the state. And they are just gorgeous, absolutely beautiful fossils. You can see the veins on the leaves. The shape of the leaf is very distinct. And they're just some of the prettiest fossils I'd ever seen from this state that I was learning so much about back in those days. Can you tell us a little bit, Renee, about fossil leaves in the western part of the state and where they come from?
Yeah. So, you know, the exceptional preservation of these fossils are known as Lagerstätten deposits, meaning that it's just exceptionally preserved. And at least in Idaho, we have a pretty amazing geologic history that helps set up the type of depositional environment for these plant fossils. Like you mentioned in the trivia question, Idaho was well, maybe I shouldn't even say it because somebody has to do trivia.
Was it warmer or colder back then?
It was much warmer.
It was warmer, yeah.
Yeah, compared to today. And so we have a fossil flora that is very different than what we see in Idaho present day. And part of the warmer temperatures were attributed to giant flood basalts that basically erupted in Washington, Oregon, and Idaho and swept across the landscape where drainage patterns of streams and rivers were blocked, and then small and large lakes were formed and disconnected from other drainage systems.
These are the Columbia River basalts? Is that the flow?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's the Columbia River flood basalt, and It's a continental flood basalt, so lava erupted out of the ground in a series of cracks, and then the lava would flow pretty great distances. It's estimated about, 210,000 kilometers cubed of lava flowed across the landscape, so it was pretty incredible.
So when I look at a lava flow that large, I'm used to this really thick, gooey stuff that's going extremely slow. Was this that, and it just took forever for that flow to really spread that far out?
You know, it wasn't thick and gooey. I see it as more of a nice, just runny flow. You could see some of those flows even in Hawaii today where lava is just moving across the landscape in a pretty slow way, but it is making some distance across the landscape. So these flows made it pretty far.
And so the flows were, like you were saying, changing the drainage patterns and blocking waterways and making lakes as a result?
Yes, yeah. And one of the good examples of that is in northern Idaho, the Clarkia fossil beds that are pretty well known to northern Idaho. It's part of the Latah Formation, and what happened there was the ancient path of the St. Mary's River was blocked by the Columbia River flood basalt. And once it was blocked, it created a very large lake in this area, and the lake was the perfect depositional setting for the preservation of some of these fossils.
Fantastic. So if I was to see one of these fossils today, what kind of rock are they on? What's the color? Can you sort of paint a picture for our listeners of what one of these slabs would look like?
Yeah. So really, you know, if you look at the area, you'll see a lot of black rock. And that black rock is the flood basalt, so the lava that went across the landscape. But between different layers of that black rock, we see a tan to gray sediment. And that tan to gray sediment, depending whether it was an ancient stream or an ancient lake, has varying grain sizes. You might have kind of mud-sized grains, at least for the lakes, a little coarser sand for the river system. But usually you see these deposits within some of the main flows of the Columbia River basalt group.
So are these deposits preserved basically because they're sandwiched in between two pieces of that basalt flow?
For the most part, yeah, a lot of the deposits are between basalt flows. But as you go a little bit more towards the south in the Payette Formation, we do see some sediments that are between the flows, but we also see a kind of last gasp of sedimentation above the last basalt flow, at least down there. And then the age-equivalent Sucker Creek flora, just a little bit more to the south of the Payette in the extreme southwest corner of the state, is part of an extensional basin. And that extensional basin had a nice lake that formed in it. So it's not quite as associated with the CRBs as the others.
So could you tell us a little bit about the kinds of leaves that are found there and what plants they represent? Are these familiar plants to us today? Would I recognize them, or are they so ancient that, you know, they represent species or types of plants that I wouldn't be familiar with at all?
Yeah, so it's pretty phenomenal. So analog modern forests today, we see a lot of these plants in Eastern Asia and then Eastern North America. Some of the swampy plants that we see, you could find in the Mississippi Valley near the Gulf of Mexico. And examples, so we have, for at least the Asian plants, we have the Chinese yew, we have Chinese fir, Chinese water pine, as well as some others. We also have different types of cedars, Don redwood, bald cypress, fir, different types of pine trees, liriodendron, which is the tulip tree. Hmm. We have different sycamores, sweet gum, maple, birch, oak, chestnut, and a lot of these names are names that are pretty familiar to most people. Locust, holly plant. There's even a leaf type that may have come from avocado or sweet bay family plant.
So some of those plants I would expect to potentially exist here in Idaho today, and many of them that you just described or listed are not ones that are found here today, I'm quite sure. What do they tell us about the environment that existed here during the time of their deposition?
Yeah. So what it was during the much warmer time during their deposition is we had warm, humid, temperate forests with broad-leaved hardwood and conifer trees that were present. And so that's why there's a eastern U.S. component, because we see a lot of broad-leaved hardwood trees as well. Forests were really thick and diverse. Plant matter accumulated at pretty high levels at some points, or some places in deposition, at least with the Payette Formation. We do see that there were small coal beds that were actually mined in the early 1900s because of all that organic material piling up. And later, after this very warm time, the temperature changed to a more arid, sagebrush to woodland, grassland, steppe environment, similar to what we see in Lewiston, Idaho, or southern Idaho today.
So how does this relate into a more global sense of climate during that time in history?
Yeah, so overall, the globe was much warmer than today. I've seen different estimates. Some people say 4 to 6 degrees, or even up to 10 degrees Fahrenheit warmer than today. Especially the Northwest was warmer than today. And then we also had fluctuating levels of precipitation during that time. In the Middle Miocene, we're starting to get the uplift of the Cascade Mountain Range. And that really affected the plant life that we see in Idaho, as well as the rain shadow developed more and more as the Cascade Mountain Range uplifted farther and farther.
You know, I want to say, too, just for our listeners, when we normally think of a 4-degree temperature swing during a normal day, it's not a big deal for us. But when you look at even a 1-degree temperature change globally, that's a massive change in temperatures, and in, you know, talking about 4 degrees, that's a pretty significant number.
Yeah, it definitely is.
When I've seen images of folks collecting these fossils, I've seen somebody maybe peeling apart a very finely layered, almost looks like a shale kind of a rock, to expose these leaves for the first time. Is that sort of how they're collected?
Yeah, especially with the Laetoh Formation. So the Laetoh Formation, especially the lake sediments, the muddy sediments, you could even stick a knife blade into the sediment that is turning into rock, but it's not that hard of a rock yet, and then peel apart the layers. And it's pretty amazing. So the layers that you see, they are, or at least the fossils that you see within the layers, that's the first time that those fossils experienced oxygen since they were deposited at the bottom of the lake. It's pretty incredible. Some of the fossils that you can excavate or examine is right when you pull them out of the rock. Some of the fossils are the original color when they were deposited. So we see browns, reds, and greens.
Wow.
And within minutes, the color starts to change. And I've seen that as well with different insects that come out of the Laetoh Formation, where they're a very iridescent, beautiful color. And then within minutes, it changes to black. And so the bottom of at least the Laetoh Formation lake near Clarkia was very calm and stable, cold, probably anoxic, and that combination of characteristics made the bottom of the lake ideal for preservation conditions. And at least on these plant fossils, so I've worked on plant fossils through a lot of different geologic times, and they are exceptional. You could see really good venation, and you could actually peel off the original material of the leaf from the rock and actually put it between, say, two pieces of glass to examine it. It's so incredible.
Yeah, that I've seen images of those, and they are just sort of breathtaking, the kind of time capsule that's naturally preserved in that part of the world. Are there animals associated with these, or is it just plants?
It's mostly plants. But like I mentioned before, insects have been found. We also found some mollusks. Indicators of freshwater sponges have been found, the spicules of freshwater sponges. And there are some fish that are found. I did hear of an account where somebody thought they saw or found part of a squirrel, but I don't think that's been written up yet. So yeah, anything really could have fallen into the lake and gotten preserved. So there you have it. But mostly it's the lake dwelling invertebrates and fish that you'll see.
So one other notion I've heard about the fossil leaves and the quality of preservation is that there might still remain some organic material that records the DNA of the plants. Has that been validated, I guess, as an idea?
It has been validated, and it's pretty incredible. So since these deposits are such exceptional preservation, people have actually extracted plant DNA from them. Magnolia leaves are the best. And then other leaf tissues and cuticles have been worked on to determine what the mean annual temperature was at different times, and to look at really how these plants were different or similar to the correlative or the similar plants that we have living today.
Tell us some more applications of you know, examining fossil leaves more generally, and what that tells us about our past and how we can apply that towards some purpose that relates to understanding our world today or maybe even forecasting for the future.
Yeah. Yeah. So determining shifting climate in the geologic past is so important to understand. It shows us how future warming or cooling climate change events will affect organisms and their response to those changes. And so as we go into a warm time, at least modernly or in the future, in the near future, we could look at the past, especially 16 million years ago, for an analog to see what would happen to this area and how would organisms react to those changes in warming climate.
are you able to offer these fossils to look at, in a sense, the time frame? Because as we warm or cool, sometimes it's dependent on how quickly or slowly we warm up or cool down. Can you get a time reference off of any of these fossils?
We do have a record, but again, we are speaking of millions of years in between some of our record. But really, my expertise is I'm looking at these plant fossils that were deposited about 16 million years ago, all the way to plant fossils that were deposited about 2 million years ago. And we have fossil localities that represent intermediate times along that range. And what we do see is, again, there was a major cooling that happened, a generalized cooling from 16 million years ago to present day. And we see a lot of these broadleaf trees go away. We see a lot of the swamp vegetation go away, or at least they're not as frequent. And we start to see a lot of the dry land, sagebrush, saltbrush, herbaceous flowering plants dominate the landscape.
So I have a general question. You work on the ancient history of landscapes and the environments and floras that provide the evidence to understand our past. How did you get interested in this in the first place?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So it was back when I was an undergraduate at Washington State University. I had a really good professor that I went to, and I said, you know, I'd love to do some sort of research. And he gave me an option, and he knew I liked paleontology, and so he gave me an option, and he said, well, I have some plant fossils that were deposited about 350 million years ago that you could work on, or fish fossils from a little older, about 400 million years ago. And it was a really hard choice, but they're both very neat, but I selected the plant fossils. And during that time, both land plants and fish were radiating. Fish were radiating throughout the ocean. Plants were starting to radiate on continental environments, and we were starting to get very large forests. And so these are really the first land plants, the records of first land plants that we see on Earth. So it was a really good project to start off on. And since then, I've worked in different geologic time ranges on plant fossils. I've done a lot of work in plant fossils that were anywhere from about 65 million years old to about 35 million years old. And then these plant fossils in Idaho are a little younger, but we're looking at anywhere from about 16 to about 2 million years.
That's great. Yeah, and there's I think it's always a bit of a surprise to learn that there are so many deposits to do research on like this, and there's so many questions, you know, yet to be asked and resolved.
Yeah.
And you can spend a lifetime doing this.
Yeah, and you know, right now I'm finding other applications for the plant fossils, and so right now Idaho has one producing oil and gas field, which is near Payette, Idaho, and I'm actually using these plant fossils to try to correlate surface rock deposits to the subsurface to try to see what the reservoir is that the oil company is going for and what do we have in the subsurface. And so correlating using these plant fossils is a really good tool that I've been using. And specifically, I'm looking at the pollen and spores of these plants.
That's fantastic. And those can be retrieved through cuttings from drill holes that are made to explore for oil in the subsurface.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's better if you have fine-grained material that looks a little bit darker so it's not as oxidized. But, yeah, we get them from well cuttings and then collect from surface deposits, and then we're trying to correlate surface to the subsurface.
That's excellent. I always like examples of where fossils are being applied for, you know, direct economic impact. I think that's always it's always important to know that's often the case of how these materials can be used too. You know, we started off the day with a question that honestly is maybe the hardest question we've asked, which is asking folks what the average temperature in Idaho was 16 million years ago. And I think we got, if you were listening carefully, I think a listener might even know the answer to this question now. So just as a reference, Boise's average temperature these days, if you take the annual average, it's about 52 degrees Fahrenheit. So about 16 million years ago, Renee, what was Idaho's temperature?
It was about 62 degrees Fahrenheit.
So that's about 10 degrees average warmer per year than it is today, which is quite a substantially greater temperature.
Definitely. So you can kind of see how our landscape has changed. It had to change because you just can't keep those plants around when you start losing heat. 10, 15 degrees colder now.
Yeah, it's a dramatic difference in terms of species that live in specific areas.
And not only that, there's the precipitation change that you were describing as well that would have supported the flora that that we're finding in those rocks in the western part of the state, correct?
Yeah.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Renee Love from the University of Idaho, for joining us today. To learn more about Dr. Love's work, please visit the geology webpage at the University of Idaho. Shows are recorded here at the studios of KISU Pocatello. Visit us at KISU.org for questions, comments, and audio for all our programs. Our theme music is by Idaho's very own Sons of Bannock. And please remember to get outside and enjoy the nature of Idaho.